Hello and welcome back to the podcast. In this episode, I'm talking with Sarah Bates about her research into tutor identity in further and adult education. So we begin by talking about Sarah's own journey through education and how she ended up becoming a tutor. And I think she's a lot of insights and knowledge about how the sector works here in Ireland. And then we talk a little bit about her research into tutor identity. Sarah interviewed many tutors for her work, and here she shares some of their stories around what professionalism means to them and what it means to be an adult education tutor. So I hope any tutors listening there, you'll be able to identify with some of these stories. So enjoy. So welcome, Sarah, to the podcast. I'm delighted to have you here. We're going to talk about your work, your research looking at identities in FE tutors. But first, I'd like to ask you a little bit about yourself, how you got into this work.
I didn't have a very straightforward entry into further education and training. My original background is social care. So from quite a young age, I was kind of working in social care areas. Like when I was about 15, I would have been doing home health and things like that at the weekends. And during the summer, kind of working with camps with kids with disability. And then when I left school, I didn't get my course of choice. I wanted to do social care, and I repeated my even cert. So I was somebody who didn't perform terribly well in mainstream school, but I knew what I wanted, and I knew that my intelligence lied with people, with working with people. And I was terrible at the Irish and the maths and the French and the science, all the subjects that, you know, you were told you were to take for your leaving cert. So take two anyway, did the leaving cert again and got enough points to come to Waterford. So I grew up in Dublin, in Talla in Dublin. And I got into Waterford to do social care. And at the time it was a very practical course. Where you did 12-month placement before you actually started. So it was brilliant.
Wow.
Years work experience behind you. And I worked in Ballyfermot in Dublin, in Chapel Lizard, and I was working with people that were coming out of prison or with family members of people who were in prison. So I had a brilliant time, and I was very sure by the time I came to college that social care was what I wanted. And then I found myself on a course where suddenly I was one of the good ones, and I was doing well in education because I was studying things I was interested in that made sense to me, psychology, sociology, social studies. And my own narrative started to change about myself. And it took a lot of time, but I kind of came out of school thinking I was stupid. I was definitely not academic. I had a very bad memory, and this education was always going to be hard. That was my narrative.
Okay.
But as the years went by, I realized, this isn't as hard. I still have to work hard, but it wasn't as hard. And you put in the effort and you actually got the rewards. Whereas, you know, I remember being in primary school and my mother, you know, every night learning the spellings, and on the Thursday night, you weren't allowed to go watch telly until you had all these spellings learned. And by Friday, I would still be only getting the 5 out of 20. Do you know? Whereas I got the rewards when I was actually studying something that stuck.
Yes.
So I did social care, and then I worked in social care for a few years, and I worked in the homeless industry. So I worked in the men's hostel in Lady Lane at the time.
Okay.
And then I moved into working with TRO, ended up working for a year in the Subla in a traveller project, which some of your tutors might know and might have worked in.
Okay.
And then I ended up, so I moved around a lot. I'd move every kind of 3 years or so. I was very interested. I'd kind of work with a particular group, kind of get to where I understood that group. And then I ended up in a job where I was working as an adult guidance counsellor with people coming out of prison or people on probation. And I trained then. I did a level 9 in adult guidance and counselling part-time, which I loved. And there was huge focus on personal development and on, I suppose, our idea of the world and our idea of education and training and the opportunities that were or weren't there for different types of people. And I got very creative in how I saw the world, but in also how I created opportunities for the people that I was working with. So these were people who were the furthest away from employment and from even maybe having the skills to sit down and be in a classroom. There would have been histories of drug abuse and you know, that's why they were there. That's why they were there with me. So to get into a point where they felt confident enough that they actually could have a different type of future, where they trusted the systems enough to, that it was worth going and pursuing education and training, and then also convincing people to give them a go, or convincing employers to give them a go. You know, so there was this whole other having to reimagine the possibilities for people. And having to change their narratives and the narratives of other people about what they could be and they could do. So I did that for a few years, and then I hurt my back. So I left that job, and I had decided I was going to be a musician anyway for a year and let my back heal. So I saved up for a year working with a hurt back, and then I was going to play music and heal. And at the same time, I decided to do a kind of a third year to the adult guidance qualification I did was 2 years, but you could stay on for a third year and do your master's.
Okay.
I did research on people in caring roles and teaching roles who get hurt and don't self-care.
So very relevant.
My story at that point. Yeah. So I had this year off where within weeks I couldn't walk. My back just disintegrated. And couldn't walk, couldn't drive, couldn't hold a guitar. There was no, musician thing had gone out the window. And I was stuck doing this master's about the self-care journey and having to learn self-care.
And, so you were a living example.
It was very, very reflective. It was very personal research. And I was talking to people who had these physical breakdowns because they weren't minding themselves in the social care and teaching roles. But anyway, I needed to be doing some kind of work. And the only place that I felt that I could go was back to Education Initiative. So Andrea Egan, who is the coordinator in Waterford, I went to her and I just said, look, I want 3 hours a week. I need something to stay sane, but I can't physically do any more than that. And she gave me 3 hours a week. And that was the start. That was in 2010. It was meant to be a stopgap. It was, for me, the right mix of social care and education. My own journey had brought me to a place where I could see that education would allow the people I had worked with, all these different groups, to transform their lives. So be it travellers, be it homeless, be it people in addiction, people who have been in trouble with the law, all these different groups, education was their key. If it was done in the right way, and if they believed in it, and they believed in themselves, and they believed in you, it would get them out of whatever they were in and move them towards a life that they could self-create. And BTI was that beautiful mix of, they worked with vulnerable groups. It was part-time, it was small groups, it was very adult-friendly. And for me, it would allow me to just work a few hours a week. So I started there and then fell in love with BTI, Back to Education Initiatives, fell in love with Andrew Megan, who allowed me to bring my past with me and to actually create groups within Back to Education Initiative. So within a year then, I had been working a lot with people in early recovery from addiction. And she facilitated me to create a Back to Education Initiative, which focused on people in early recovery from addiction.
Okay.
So I was still working with the groups I was passionate about. So that was 2010, and it's 2021 now, and I'm still working with Back to Education Initiative, and I'm still in love with Andrew Megan.
It sounds like you settled into the job that was right for you.
Yeah, I just found my career tends to move. So it tends to shift and it tends to change. And I found that I moved jobs every 3 years or so. But when I came into further education and training, I started working with Back to Education and I continued to, but the groups changed and the subjects I was teaching changed.
Okay.
And then I also started working with community education. And I also worked with local training initiatives. So I just found that within the world of FET, there were lots of things to move around. And that there was always challenges and there was always changes and there were always different groups. And I needed that. You know, I had come from working in an emergency hostel. I needed to be stimulated every day and to have new challenges. And that's what kept me going. And I found all of that in FET.
Do you know, that's hopeful for our own students who are usually the people who are listening to this podcast, that there's so much scope to move around and to develop within further education and training. because you've had such a varied career, and it sounds like you really were able to bring all of the experience from various social care roles that you held and bring it into the further education environment. People think there's this one path or one route into FET. I get my qualifications, I do my training, and then I become a teacher in this subject or this sector.
So about 4 or 5 years into working in FET, I realized I'm not going anywhere. is who I am now, but I'm not qualified. Yeah. And what was really interesting is I remember when I went to look, could I work in Impact Education Initiatives? And I had a social care degree at level 8 and I had a level 9 adult guidance qualification. And I was told, go do your train to trainer level 6. And okay. I thought, okay. And I went and I did my train to trainer and it was brilliant. It was a very good course and it gave me what I needed to be able to have the skills to operate effectively within a class, which is different, you know, to the other settings. And they were right in assuming that just because I had level 9 qualification didn't mean I had the skills and that I was equipped to teach or to train. And the level 6 gave me what I needed. But I was kind of really getting into this identity of being a further education and training tutor, facilitator, trainer. I was different labels depending on where I was. But that was becoming my identity. And I kind of felt I want to go and give this time, you know, and do my own kind of personal and professional development and go get the qualification as a further education teacher. So I went and I did the teacher education qualification at level 9. And that was good. And I suppose it consolidated for me my professional identity. And it meant that I kind of felt like I was standing solid in my job and in my identity. But out of that came this other side then. You know, I got interested in who we are, in who FET, as in further education and training practitioners are. And I use that phrase, FET practitioners, because I'm talking about teachers, tutors, facilitators, trainers, instructors. Mm-hmm. And we all have our own labels, which we're employed under. But we also have our own labels, which we prefer and which we identify with for many, many reasons. Yeah. And for me, it was never actually teacher. It was always tutor or facilitator. Yeah. Because for me, teacher is what they had in primary and secondary. And I'm not that. And this FET sector is not that. Whereas for other people, you know, they're very attached to it and there's no judgment. It's just, how do I see myself and which term best reflects how I see myself?
I could identify with that because in third level, we're lecturers, but I just feel very uncomfortable with the label of lecturer.
Yeah. I mean, we work in adult education and you don't lecture adults if you're doing it right anyway.
Yeah.
So it is a very inappropriate term for the type of work we do. Now, in other parts of higher education, they're lecturing, but what we do is facilitation, and is tutoring and is imparting information, but building on what you already know, pulling out what you already know. Do you know, it's not lecturing. It's very, very far from it.
Yeah.
But I got interested in all that side, you know, the identity side. And I also got interested in how we were being portrayed and understood by the powers that be. So the teaching council, the government, the Department of Education, our employers. And for me, the next step then was to do some research on that. And I was absolutely blessed. The month we were finishing up our course, our teacher education qualification, these funded PhDs came out. And one of them was looking at the identity of further education teachers. Carol O'Byrne, whom I had huge respect for at the time. And I just thought, this is written for you.
Yeah.
And it's funded. So I applied for it and absolutely blessed that I got it. That was 2015. It was meant to be a 3-year PhD. I'm still at it. God bless me. God bless Carol.
There's I don't think anyone's ever done a PhD in 3 years.
Definitely not a humanities based one anyway. Yeah. But we're still on that journey. But my FET career took on another dimension. It went into research and understanding our sector better. And I was still working in further education and training. And then in 2019, I came in to work in WIT and I'm now teaching on the teacher education qualification course.
Okay.
And I'm getting to impart my experience and my knowledge, but also maybe push it a bit, push the boundaries, challenge the narratives that are out there about further education teachers, because we work in the further education training sector. Even the labels that are applied to us by the Teaching Council or by the teacher education qualification courses, they don't take in how big the sector is. They don't take in the diversity, the terminology that we're being employed as out there.
Okay.
So I just think that my career in VET keeps taking different bends and turns and is mingled the whole time with my own personal education journey and my own personal development and my personal and professional development. They are the one, you know, everything I am is what I bring to my job. You know, I'm developing both at the same time.
You're still working in further education as well as higher education?
I work one morning a week in VET education. But I also feel that because I'm now teaching teachers, I need to stay in touch with the sector to be really authentic. I'm there because I am one of you, but I need to stay one of you.
So can we talk a little bit about your research? Because your research is in teacher identity.
So a big part of my PhD research was to look at the identities held by FET practitioners, further education and training practitioners. And one of the first questions was, what kind of identity do they have? And is there a shared identity? And is it a professional identity? And, you know, we don't fit into the traditional profession. We don't have a shared education and training past. We don't have a common entry. We don't have one qualification. We don't have a professional body that represents all of us. So we don't fit into that. So you could debate whether we're a profession. However, anybody you speak to will call themselves and their colleagues professionals. Therefore, we have a professional identity. People were able to name what that meant. You know, and for the people I spoke to, what was interesting is it wasn't about having a teacher education qualification and it wasn't about being registered with the Teaching Council. Those things never really came up when people defined what made them professional or their colleagues professional. What they had as, you know, you need to be able to do these things in order to be consider yourself professional was that you would have subject related qualifications.
Okay.
So whatever you were teaching in, that you were an expert in that. And in addition to that, and as important, if not more important, was industry experience. So like if you were teaching culinary skills, you had worked in the sector.
Yes.
That there was this big difference between having the subject qualification and the life experience, the real world experience, because you're in adult education and you were meant to be teaching about the real world and preparing them for the real world. And how could you do that if you didn't have that experience? So for the people I was talking to, they were saying, you know, it's having the qualifications and the experience in your subject area, which was interesting because that was different for different people. So, you know, if you were teaching social care, well, then, you know, you'd done your social care degree and you'd worked in it. But if you were teaching photography, you know, there may not have been a qualification in that. So it meant that you were recognized by your professional organization and you had experience of being a photographer in the real world. So it looked different depending on what your area was. And even with literacy, because it's not like you would necessarily, you know, need to have an English degree in order to teach literacy.
Yes.
But people who were teaching literacy were saying, but you did need real world experience. And they also defined being professional as kind of behaving in a professional way. So the kind of the stuff you would expect, like being respectful, punctual, but they also kind of had like being fair and knowing how to be fair, being caring about your learners, but also being passionate about adult learning, and that was really important. I spoke a lot about how qualifications wouldn't give you what you needed to be truly effective in FET, that you needed to have this right personality and you needed to genuinely care about adult learning and about the way you did that and the spaces you created. So maybe if you were a qualified primary or secondary school teacher, it didn't necessarily translate that you were going to be effective in FET. So being qualified to teach did not mean that it would work, particularly in literacy. Do you know, it's nearly like you need to be able to do it quite structured while breaking all the rules at the same time. So that came out anyway, was like, how did they define professional? And they all felt that they did have a professional identity. Those were the things that were the shared parts, you know, that they could see that this is what you do to be a professional and effective FET practitioner. But their identities, then their individual identities, were so interesting. And what fed into that, like what made them who they were and how they were in the classroom, was a mix of so many things that had gone before. And if you think about my journey, I'm very much a product of my past occupations. But even my past occupation, like choosing to go into healthcare at age 15, I grew up in a house where we were a foster family. you know, I was a product of my parents. I was a product of my upbringing. Yeah. So it all comes from who I am today, all stems from day one, you know, and the people who reared me. And when I looked at the individual identities that people held in vet, so I interviewed in depth kind of six people working in back to education initiatives and six people working in post leaving cert courses, because I wanted courses that were comparable, but that were also different. So like one full time, one part time, one more mainstream traditional way going on, the other one more alternative, adult friendly, smaller classes. So they were comparable but different. And what came out of them was that for some people, like the family of origin was huge. You know, the principles they were living by and living out in their classroom were very much related to the principles and the beliefs that had been passed on to them by their parents. So you had some people who were being raised to know what they had, to know the opportunities that they had, and to know that other people don't get those opportunities, but that doesn't make you better than anybody else. And your job is to try and create those opportunities for others. Yeah. That was big in literacy, was trying to make sure that people had opportunity and that nobody was better than anybody else just because they were more qualified or had a better education. Yeah. Then there was also the community of origin for some people. So there was one person in particular who half of his class who he'd gone to secondary school were dead. And of the ones that were still alive, most were in prison. And he was kind of saying he was lucky. He met the right people. He met the right teachers. He got the right opportunities. And he's now teaching other people. But that drives him to give others the opportunities that he got.
Yeah.
So he's very much living out that, you know, the sliding doors, like which way could he have gone, you know, and he's making sure that people get that option. Then as people kind of grew up, being a parent seemed to be hugely significant. People talked about how their world perception shifted and who they were shifted. So I remember somebody saying, I wouldn't have been able to work in literacy before I was a parent because I wouldn't have had the patience. I wouldn't have understood the complexity of learning. You know, for her, learning had been quite easy. She had a very good memory. And she said it wasn't until she witnessed her own children learning that she realized people do it so differently. And just a huge amount of patience you need. And she said that she wouldn't have been able to be a literacy tutor before she was a parent. And somebody else had a child who had a very severe disability, and he changed what he was doing completely. And his kind of driving force now in vet is to create opportunities for people with disability and to create a world that he wants his son to be able to grow up into. He wants his son to have those opportunities. So for some people, it was massive being a parent. The two big common ones were the impact of past education. So people were doing things or not doing things based on lessons that they had learned. Yeah. And quite a few of them, like myself, didn't come through the school system in one direction. So a lot of them had appreciation for the alternative spaces for the vet sector. And they were trying to, again, create opportunities that they had received.
Yeah, I see that in our classes as well. The tutors I talk to in class, a lot of them either didn't have success in mainstream education or would have found it very difficult. And maybe that's what draws people to teaching in further education, because they see that there are possibilities here that are different to what they would have experienced.
And I think it makes you better. That's not to say that somebody who, you know, sailed through mainstream can't be good, but they actually have to learn more than the person who didn't sail through. Because if you don't know what it is to struggle, if you don't know what it is to not understand or not fit, you're not going to naturally take those things into account. Whereas people who struggle or who didn't fit try to create spaces where they would have been comfortable and therefore create more alternative spaces. I struggled with maths the whole way through and I barely passed maths. But I taught level 3 maths once. Now, it nearly killed me. And I don't know that I would do it again. But I was able to break it down and I assumed nothing. And people learned in my class that maybe hadn't learned anywhere else. But that's because for me, I had to break it right down because it didn't make sense to me. And I think I was a better maths teacher for that. So I suppose just carrying on what kind of informed people's identities. So there was the whole past education. And then massively was the past occupational roles. And you can really hear that in my story about how I still identify as a social care worker. I still identify as an adult guidance counsellor. And now that I am a lecturer and a researcher, they're not terms I applied to myself. Really, those identities haven't dropped down yet. I'm still a tutor who researches things that are relevant to FET. You know, I'm not a researcher, I'm just researching things I'm interested in.
Yeah.
But I think I'll grow into those identities. I think those identities will become part of me as I become more experienced in that side of things. Yeah. But it was huge. It's huge in FET. When you talk to people, most FET practitioners, that is not their first job. You don't grow up and go, I'm going to be an adult educator.
Yeah.
That occupational identity remains their primary identity. So if I'm a photographer or I'm a chef, I'm probably a chef who teaches other people how to be a chef. And I found that a lot, that particularly people who worked in people industries, that that identity didn't go anywhere. It just became part of who they were now as a tutor. And that had to do with the fact that they were still passionate about their past industry. And what they wanted to do was pass on that passion to others, or they wanted to be in that industry. But like, particularly chefing, you know, if you have a family and you, and you're used to working antisocial hours in restaurants or being a head chef, something like that, that you find, okay, it doesn't fit anymore, but I still love chefing. So being to working and tutoring chefs or in culinary skills or using cooking and literacy, you know, they find that they still get to work with what they love, but in a different way. So there's, it's still all about the passion they have for food. I also found that a lot of people were using their FET practitioner role to try and better their past occupation sector. So you have people who are teaching in, say, childcare or healthcare, and are really concerned with producing good workers for the sector, or improving the sector by maybe increasing the confidence of their learners. So I remember a childcare tutor saying to me, we're undervalued as a sector, but we undervalue ourselves. And if I can instill confidence, you know, in my learners, well, then I'm doing a small bit to change the sector. You know, so people are using their FET roles to still contribute to their past occupational sector. And another big part was most had worked in either different parts within FET, or they had worked in different education sectors. So some of the people I interviewed were previously primary or secondary school teachers, or had worked in higher ed and had worked in different parts of FET. And particularly if you work in part-time FET, it's cruel to the tutor. And, you know, it's hard to get a proper contract. You're not paid when school is out. You never know where you're going to be, all that stuff. But the payoff was that you can bring yourself wholly into that room, that you can work holistically with your learners, that you have control, you know, that you get to decide, okay, look, we have to do this for maybe accreditation, but I can also bring in this other content that I'm passionate about. I can do it in a way that I feel is best, and we've got time, you know. So but they were, they knew what they had because they'd worked in other sectors. So I saw like lecturers deciding not to go back to higher education because they found that the hook for them was the relationship they got to build with a learner that they don't necessarily get to do in higher ed with bigger classes in shorter spaces of time. And then they didn't go back. And yet they all spoke about, but I have a plan B if I ever don't get my hours. And lots of them had gotten to that point many, many times where they wondered whether they'd have to give up and go back to, you know, the permanent pensionable job. And that was interesting to see that people still chose to take the risk to stay in FET because of the hooks that were there.
Yeah.
You know, the rewards are personal as opposed to professional. You know, you don't get any pay rises, you don't get paid during holidays if you're working in the part-time sector. There's no progression unless you progress out into management. But that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, and we will follow up with that. I think we are going to talk about employment in the sector in another podcast. So just for people to keep tuned. But yeah, that's tough though, because you really, like, it's obviously worth it though for the personal reward, but it's tough that there's still contractual and employment issues, and that it's a struggle to work in the sector and not know your future in the sector.
They rely on goodwill. They rely on the fact that most people who stay in part-time FET are there because they truly care about their learners. So they bank on you giving the extra time, giving the extra hours and taking the hits and being willing to go on social welfare for the summer to stay doing that job.
Yeah.
You know, so they're banking on your humanity.
Yeah.
But what was also interesting was I found that people tended to be most heartened by the lowest level of learner they worked with, in the sense that the people I was talking to had worked, you know, some maybe had only worked at level five, but others had worked at like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah.
And they were driven by the values they picked up when they worked with the lowest level. So if people had worked at level one or two, that's where their heart was. Even when they worked with other levels, they still brought the learning from that. And there's something about that, because in some ways, the lower the level, the less well you get treated in some ways. And certainly, you know, the difference between part-time and full-time. But that's where the heart is. That's where the real transformative stuff happens and where it's the space to be most magical. Less numbers, longer time. We're starting to lose some of that, but literacy and ComEd are still, you know, fighting the good fight to make sure that not everything has to be accredited and that learners get and tutors get extra time and all that. But that's where there's space to create the most change and have the most impact.
I hear that from literacy tutors all the time in our classes.
And the best days are often the unpredictable ones, you know, where it didn't go to plan, you threw it out, but something shifted in you and in the learners.
It's fascinating. I could sit here and listen to you all day talking about your research.
And I think that is something that maybe your listeners could tap into is that I'm not saying anything that people don't actually know. It's just I'm putting it together and it's being called research and it's being written about. At some point it will, you know, appear in articles, but very little is known about who we are, yet we know who we are.
Oh, absolutely.
And we have a responsibility to play that academic game, you know, to write about ourselves and not wait for somebody else to research us. And I see that as maybe the next stage in my career is to facilitate vet practitioners to write about themselves and to write about what they know and to get it out there, because the Teaching Council don't know us. The Department of Education don't know us. A lot of our employers don't really know what goes on behind the closed door in our classrooms as well, you know, and how can they if we don't tell them? And if we don't tell them in the way they understand, which is articles, research, you know, that's the medium that gets recognized. Therefore, we need to play that game.
Yeah,
for our own sake and for the sake of our learners, so that people don't get to make decisions about our sector that don't understand it.
They're the best people to inform policy and decision makers.
They know their learners, and they also know we're in a sector where it's increasingly the symbols of success are completion, certification and progression onto higher certification or employment, particularly in literacy. That is not the game we're playing. That's not the game our learners are playing.
Yeah.
For some of them, a certain level may be the highest level they're going to get to, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And that might be ability, but it might also be because that's what they want. I'm there so that I can do homework with my kids. I don't need you to be telling me now I need to do a higher level course and I need to go get a job. That's not success to me. Being home with my children and being effective at the table doing the homework, or being able to apply for a passport and travel, that's what's going to make my life better. Not doing an 11.5 qualification, something I'm not interested in.
Yes. And I think while there's a place for certification, and certainly it can be a great motivator for somebody who has never seen success in education to get a level one or level two qualification, that we need to be mindful too, though, that we're not losing the goals of the learners in the process.
Yeah. And you need uncertified spaces to bring people back into certified spaces, particularly if they've got past negative experiences in education. They need to come in and test the waters and feel safe before they sign up to something that they feel they can fail at. You can't fail if there's no test.
Yeah.
So let them just have a positive experience of education first. And then kind of go, how would you feel about, you know, trying this out?
Yeah.
And sneaking the tests in.
Yeah.
Which I think happens a lot in literacy. The assessments are snuck in.
Yeah. And at the beginning, an in-certification is probably seems like a million miles away. But by the time they've gone through the process, they're much closer to that. It seems like something they can achieve.
And it's changing the narrative. You know, if you have failed exams in the past, then you think you will continue to fail anything that presents as some form of an exam.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's your story. So your story has to change before you can perform differently. We, you know, we will make ourselves fail if we think we're going to fail. Whereas if it just kind of happens quite naturally and my own personal story changes, then I can risk going for the certification at the end.
You have so much to talk about, and I could stay here with you all day. The tutors listening to this, they'll hear themselves in this somewhere. So thank you so much, Sarah. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.